I'm not used to being videotaped, so I'm worried I'm going to say something bad about somebody. And I'll try to make sure I restrict that to people in the room then, so I can tell whether I've offended you or not. So this talk is a mixture of a bunch of bits and pieces of stuff. So if it seems like it's not terribly coherent, that's because it isn't. But let me at least try to start by telling you what the talk's going to be, so that if it's it's not going to seem to make sense right from the beginning. So is this going to work? Sort of. Oh yeah. Okay. I'm going to use this button here because I know what I'm doing. So there's a cosmological model. I don't know exactly what the audience is here, but I assume everybody has heard a whole bunch of talks on cosmology. Hands up if you've never heard somebody give a standard cosmology talk. You're lying, though, right? You want me to pick on you already? It's a volunteer thing. The cosmological parameters vary because of sampling. The universe is a throw of the dice. This is a relatively well-known thing among cosmologists, but sometimes is a little new to people in other branches of physics. The cosmological parameters as we define them vary in time. So in some sense, they're a really crappy set of parameters, the standard ones, because they're not, they really depend on when now is. And it may be that some of them also vary in space. And then some of the physical constants may do the same thing. So what I'm trying to do is step you through from stuff that's definitely real to stuff that's somewhat speculative in a way that maybe makes, by the time you get to the bottom, not quite as surprising as it would have been had I not given you the stuff at the top. And the warning is that I'm talking about variation here. And one of the things that I'm talking about is a change in maybe the way that you view the cosmological model. So for a few of the old hands in here, like Nayesh, this is all completely familiar. But for the rest of you, there's going to be a few things here which are a little unfamiliar. So there's a warning here. And I put a little danger sign on here because part of the warning is some of you in the room will be arguing with me before the end of the talk, right? And I know John's already arguing with me, but some of the rest of you too will be arguing with me before the rest of the talk. So there's a few sort of subtle little things about the cosmological model that I'm going to try and get over to you, which are maybe slightly new. So that's really the basis of the talk, and then we'll see how far we get through. Let me start by reminding you of the standard cosmological model. So here is the summary. It's general relativity with the simplest solution that we could imagine. We really have no reason to have expected the solution to be homogeneous and isotropic like it is, but it really seems to be the case. The universe is expanding. That's the thing that if Einstein had been genuinely smart, he would have predicted. We have the microwave background, which is a thing the universe has given us, which gives fantastic amounts of information from which we can learn all the other stuff. It is true that there's other things in astrophysics. I'll mention those in a minute. But really, the CMB is the thing that absolutely nails the standard model of cosmology. The initial conditions in the universe are about as simple as you can expect. We have Gaussian initial conditions, which is sort of maximally random. We have scale invariant initial conditions, which means that it's democratic in scale. So this, again, is about as simple as you could get. And then the first thing on this list, which isn't about as simple as you could get, is that the universe appears to need some stuff that you wouldn't have guessed was there. So the universe is dominated by dark energy. We don't really know what that is, except we've given it a name. And the matter in the universe is mostly dark matter, and we don't really know what that is, except we've given it a name. So we end up, when we put all that together, with what we call the Big Bang model, with a bunch of extra things that we've learned since the 60s about the contents of the model, the initial conditions, the solutions of GR that we need, and so on. So then that brings us to a sort of picture of the evolving history of the universe. This is a thing Paul Chollard put together for a Planck document. It's a very nice color picture of how the universe goes from stuff we really don't know about through stuff that we know really very well into stuff that we don't really know about. Okay.
There's a lot of primordial magnetic field, I guess, that causes the heart gyrating.
Okay, no comment. So how do we know so much about the universe? It's this cosmic fingerprint. This is one of the WMAP publicity images. So it's really this cosmic microwave background that tells us, fixes what the cosmological model is. And then, of course, there's all the rest of astrophysics too, which helps, right? So, you know, there's other parts of astrophysics for which you can win Nobel Prizes and all sorts of things. Whenever anybody shows you how well a future supernova experiment can do, what they're plotting is the future supernova experiment plus Planck. They don't always tell you that, but it's true. So you totally fix what's happening at last scattering, and then there's stuff you don't know from the CMB. So then on top of that, you learn what's happening at low redshift. But you really need this anchor of the CMB model. So it really is this fantastic linear theory, simple physics thing that just nails a million sigma worth of information at redshift 1,000. So that's the basis of the standard model of cosmology. So let me contrast that with the standard model of particle physics. So the standard model of particle physics, as we know, you can sum it all up in one slide, and all the boxes are filled, and there's a box called H, which everybody believes is already filled, basically, but we don't quite know the number to put in the box. Okay? This is a quantum field theory with a group structure. It's hard, gory math to describe this model. It's the most successful model in the whole of physics, like, ever. So you can predict things to a whole bunch of decimal places. The list of predictions that have been confirmed is huge, right? So this is what we normally think of as the standard model. And it's about 35 years old or something like that. So let's contrast that with the standard model of cosmology. The standard model of cosmology bears a passing resemblance to that previous model. Of course, any genuine theory of everything has to explain both, right? But the standard model of cosmology is different. You can't predict it based on the standard model of particle physics. There's some extra ingredients. So we don't know where the initial conditions came from. So that's probably physics beyond the standard model, whatever it is. And we don't know where all the parameters come from. There's about half a dozen parameters that you need currently. And the most imaginative physicist has about a dozen free parameters in their model. Okay, so even Dick Bond has 13 or something. I don't know exactly how many. That's a different. That's a different kind of. That's not a cosmologist. I'll talk about that a little towards the end, but only in a disparaging way. So it's a bit like the standard model of particle physics, but it's really quite different. So for one thing, the parameters are not nearly as well defined. Okay, some of the parameters vary in time. Some of the parameters are genuinely stochastic in a way that the standard model of particle physics parameters are not, even if they're stochastic in the sense that Neil mentioned. And we really don't know what the parameter set is. So we can always invent new parameters, whereas the standard model of particle physics is a kind of self-contained thing. So right now in cosmology, we have six parameters that we need to describe the model, and that really comes from the CMB alone, right? With the sixth one being the slope of the spectrum that is somewhat different from one. And then it's the rest of astrophysics that you need to get all the other parameters, right? So let me be a little more phenomenological in describing the standard model of particle physics. So I'm not a particle physicist. There's lots of different ways of of describing this model, but here's one that I chose. So there's a bunch of masses, there's a bunch of mixing angles, there's three parameters that you need for the electroweak physics, and there's a bunch of choice here in which ones you choose, but there's three. You need a parameter for the strong CP violating phase, even although as far as we can tell it's zero. So that's a bit like some of the parameters in the standard model of cosmology, like 1 plus W, where you stick it in as a parameter, even although as far as we can tell it's zero. And the flatness of the universe, which you stick in as a parameter, even although as far as we can tell it's zero. And then the last one is you need an extra constant to describe strong physics. And again, there's a bunch of choices, but I chose one of them. So if you put all that together, there's 26 parameters in the standard model of particle physics. And, you know, people discuss whether there's some of this is stochastic in some philosophical sense. Real physicists only do it the weekend. Oh, what did I do there? The wrong way. I didn't put Newton's constant in there, but it's coming, actually. So if you were to describe this model from first principles, you would use the obvious naming convention, which is not used in particle physics, right? Which was given to us by these guys. Let me contrast that with the standard model of cosmology, which you can write down in the same sort of way, phenomenological way, you can write down in this way. So we have a temperature, which is the temperature of the microwave background today. We have a time scale, you can use inverse Hubble constant. There's four densities that you need. So the density in cosmological constant called dark matter, the baryons and the neutrinos. There's a pressure, which is the equation of state of the dark energy. There's a mean free path, which is the amount of scattering that reionization does. This is not a first principles parameter because you can derive it from the other parameters, except we can't. So right now it has to be stuck in there because we don't know how to get it from a calculation. But in principle, it just comes from all the other parameters somehow. And then you need about four parameters to describe the initial conditions. So you can argue about exactly how many here, but this is the usual thing is you need something to describe the overall amplitude, the slope, the running of the slope, and something to describe the gravitational wave contribution, the tensor to scalar ratio. So we end up with four descriptors for that. And in principle, the tensors have a slope and a running and so on, but that's just buried in cosmic variance, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. So we end up with 12 parameters, and a bunch of these are currently set to their default values in the six parameter subset, which you need, right? And again, if we were to describe those from a sort of first principles naming convention, we would use the obvious naming convention, right? Which was brought to us by these guys. Oh, do you want to do the Hawaiian alphabet song? I like to sing in every talk I give. Not really, because I'm a really, really bad singer. But I taught my kids this when they were little. So shall we go? Does anybody else want to do it? So it goes A, E, H, I, K, L, M, N, O, P, U, W. There you go. You didn't know you were going to get a song today. That's an added benefit. So let me talk about time variation of these parameters. So H naught and all the omegas are all time dependent, and the temperature of the microwave background. We use them as parameters in the standard model because the time variation is really slow. Okay, and we're kind of hardwired in cosmology to think about now being a really special time because it happens to be when we live. But in a kind of global context of looking at the model, it's a kind of poor choice to choose parameters that vary with time. The time variation is very slow, of course. It's essentially the age of the universe is the characteristic time, but nevertheless, they do vary. So we could define a new set of parameters, and I'll do that towards the end of the talk, which don't really vary with time. Let me just, so let me just summarize that this makes the standard model of cosmology different for two reasons compared to the standard model of particle physics or any experimental physics thing that you've ever thought about, right? So the one thing that's different, and we're kind of used to thinking about this guy, is that the universe is kind of unique in the sense that it's the universe, right? So there's a bunch of stuff like conservation of energy, which gets a bit awkward when you talk about the whole universe, right? So, you know, we can, if we like, have an argument over lunch about whether energy is conserved in an expanding universe. And that argument could take a long time because it's not clear how you define and so on. But the second thing on here is that there's only one now, right? Which is also a special thing about the cosmological model and our view of when we live as cosmologists trying to learn about the universe. So there's actually two things that are different, and people don't always remember about the second one, which I'll talk a little more about later. Just to give you a detailed example of how slow the universe is to evolve, this is a map of the microwave sky starting with today's WMAP sky and then evolving in time. This is scale factor going all the way up past scale factor of 10. So this is billions and billions and billions of years. And you can see that on the large scales, the CMB doesn't really evolve at all. On the small scales, there's some extra stuff coming inside the horizon, if you like. And in a lambda model, it goes completely frozen because it's just like dropping your grandmother into a black hole, right? She never quite gets there, right? So in a lambda model, there's this horizon, and the universe is like an inside-out star, but it's actually like an inside-out frozen star, right? Being the old name for black holes. So this is a calculation that I did with postdocs Adam Moss and Jim Zibin. I actually thought about this, how to do this calculation for years, and Adam Moss came to me as a new postdoc, and I explained the problem to him and said, I can't even quite formulate the calculation. And Adam said, you just calculate the n equal time correlator. And I said, well, yeah, you calculate the n equal time correlator, obviously. But how do you do that? And he said, well, you just write this code. And about an hour later, we had the first thing. And I think he still thinks probably that I knew how to do it. But shh, don't tell him anybody. Oh, a question? You can ask a question.
Years of WMAP observation.
No.
I mean,
Reid, this is such an interesting topic that we wrote two papers on it, and there's at least one other paper on this subject, so that the paper contains plots of how hard that would be to do, right?
I mean, if you
increase the angular resolution. Angular resolution dies at some point, right? I mean, there's a finite amount of information there. Turns out the easiest thing to see vary would be the dipole, because we're going around the galaxy, right? So in fact, if you waited long enough, not only does the dipole change, but all the foregrounds change. And if you sort of try and think about how to really do this, it's a mess, right? Because you know we're seeing the foregrounds from a different. So even if you could do it, you couldn't do it, is what I'm saying. But the signal to noise is really, 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 really small, and you would have to calibrate the experiment to an unheard of precision and so on. It's in these papers.
It's a long way to the future.
It's a long way to the future,
so
yeah.
We'll be able to do all kinds of things.
Yeah. Yeah, and you'll be able to read these papers long before that. Okay, so let me move on to what's actually a different topic. The cosmological information is also stochastic, right? So what do I mean by that? The underlying universe is a realization of the model. So the picture we have is that there's an average kind of universe. There's a power spectrum of perturbations, and there's a bunch of dice throwing that picked out precisely what the modes were that described the observable universe that we live in. So what that means is that on the largest scales, this sampling variance is actually non-negligible. So you're used to thinking about an experiment in which you just sample more or something, but as I said, there's one universe. So when you get to large scales, there's a finite number of samples. So then there's a variance between the thing that you measure and the underlying model that you're trying to get a handle on, which you sort of typically include as an error bar when you compare data to theory, but it's really a theory error bar, right, in some sense. So you can measure as precisely as you like our universe, meaning our observable volume. But there's a finite amount of information you can get about what the underlying universe would be like, right? So this is a concept that makes sense to everybody. So this is usually called cosmic variance in cosmology, and it's the name of this blog that Sean Carroll and a bunch of his mates have, which is actually a pretty readable blog. And if I wasn't busy doing science all the time and just reading blogs, I would read this blog. But as the t-shirt says, I'm too busy doing science. Nobody knows exactly who came up with the phrase cosmic variance. And I've asked a bunch of people in cosmology, and I get the usual predictable response, which is? No. Me. Right? No, not me. Whoever I ask, right? So I ask several famous cosmologists, and they go, oh, that was me. So that was not very helpful. So I have not managed to find out who came up with this phrase first. These guys used it for the name of their blog. I asked these guys, they have no idea. I said, it's the name of your blog, right? You know, if you name your child something, you have a story, right? So, but no, they just thought it sounded good. So a cosmic variance is the thing that blows up the error bars on the left-hand side here. So let me show you. This is from the latest update of the review article that I write with George Smoot in the Particle Data Book. So this is a compilation of current CMB anisotropy data, taking sort of all the best experiments, throwing away places where error bars are big, and then just culling data sets when they're obviously not adding anything. So being fairly ruthless now, you only need at most 5 of the experiments. Okay, I mean, all the other ones help confirm and so on, but really now it's mostly WMAP and SPT, but ACBAR, ACT, and QUAD also add in the intermediate range. So what you can see is, you know, there's 1 peak, 2 peaks, 3 peaks, 4 peaks, 5 peaks, 6 peaks, maybe 7 peaks, right? So there really is this acoustic signature. This is harmonics of sound waves. Pretty hard to imagine that a totally different view of where these came from could be correct. So we really know that the universe recombined at redshift 1000. There were sound waves fluctuating on all scales, including those that are apparently acausal at that time. All the modes started, you know, the gong banged at the same time for everybody. So there's a sort of synchronization of all the modes in the very early universe, which in the typical picture is because they're all in the growing mode because they happened at very early times. Maybe it's inflation or something that Neil likes, or whatever it is. But this is telling us that we're really on the right track with the physics at redshift like 1000 and somewhat earlier. But what I wanted to show you this plot for was that the error bars over here are much bigger than the error bars in here. Right? So that's because we're plotting not just the experimental error bars, but the error bars for comparing the data to the theory. So we include this cosmic variance here. Because what we're trying to get at is the underlying yellow line, which you can hardly see here. And I plotted it in yellow deliberately because you don't really need it anymore, right? It used to be that you needed a line to really see where the data went. And now you can, you know, the line you can really take away entirely, right? So every power on here is, every squared amplitude of ALMs is a Gaussian random number with variance, whatever the power spectrum is. So every power on here is a chi-squared distribution with 2L plus 1 degrees of freedom. And when L gets small, that gets big, right? So that's cosmic variance. So for example, C2 has 5 degrees of freedom. So that's a pretty wide chi-square distribution, which means it really doesn't matter how big or small the quadrupole is. It doesn't put much constraint on anything. Since each of the CLs, yeah. Yeah, so the question is, what's chi-square, right?
Yeah.
So for overall chi-square, not chi-square, each chi-square. What's the overall chi-square? And the answer is, it's pretty good.
Pretty good, but as good as it should be.
Yeah, it's as good as it should be, right? So.
But there's the ancillary question, which is, are they really all consistent within their own errors? And I guess, I mean, yeah.
Every single one of them.
You have a residual between two data sets, even though you have a sufficiently small chi-square.
Yeah.
That system. Presumably those are all calibrated and cross-calibrated.
Yeah, so the data are, you know, for a physics experiment, the data are really fantastically well cross-calibrated and so on. It's not double-blind like we're told we're supposed to do these days, but I don't know how to do a cosmology experiment double-blind, because the data product is that you're really interested in being blind about is 4 steps removed from the, right? So I don't know where you put in the, anyway, that's another lunchtime argument that we can have. Since I've told you that the best cosmological information comes from the CMB and all the multiples in the CMB are cosmic variance limited, the parameters that we extract are just a compression of the information in the CLs, right? So the parameters must also have cosmic variance, right? So I could parameterize the information about the universe by telling you the CLs and their error bars, right? And it's just not a very useful phenomenological way of telling you the information, but it's exactly the same set of information as telling you the values of the 6 parameters. So the values of the 6 parameters also have cosmic variance, not always thought about, but it's a fact. So in other words, the parameters are the parameters for our Hubble patch. And they are not the parameters, right? So a place where this becomes manifestly clear is in the temperature. The temperature is often not thought about as a parameter, so there's actually 7 parameters in the standard model of cosmology currently. You need this guy, it's so well measured that people normally fix it. Okay, so the current estimate is that it's about 6 or something in this 4th decimal place is the current error bar. There's some argument about what exactly the error bar should be here because it's really systematics dominated. It all comes from the FIRAS experiment and its reanalysis. But what would happen if this was 10 times better? And 10 times better is doable. If you were to redo the COBE FIRAS experiment using pieces of equipment that you can get in the equipment shop downtown where you buy a new CMB spectrum measuring kit, right? Then you could do 10 times better right now, right? It would cost you a lot of millions of dollars and you'd have to launch a thing into space and so on. But it's totally doable to get this one order of magnitude better, right? The cosmic variance on this guy is something like the variance on the fluctuation on the Hubble scale, right? So the fluctuation on the Hubble scale is something times 10 to the minus 5. We could be in a 3 sigma fluctuation and it wouldn't be terribly uncomfortably unlikely. So this thing should vary at about the 10 to the minus 4 level before we know that we're talking about. So if this got better by a factor of 10, you would have to worry about what it really is that you're measuring, right? So it is not soon, right? It is not going to be the temperature of the background universe. It's going to be the temperature of the CMB last scattering surface relative to us and so on, right? So I just tell you that because this is almost real, right? It's almost a thing you have to worry about. So this is dominated by FIRAS, and this is The new, slightly better error bar is from the reanalysis by Fixum in the last couple of years. Right? So it's come down a bit. I mean, the central value hasn't really changed.
The proposal for this higher precision.
There's been a lot of things discussed. I'm not aware of a thing that's on the conveyor belt for happening, right? And the reason is because there's no deviations from this. At one order of magnitude better sensitivity, there's no deviations from a black body that are particularly interesting, except the stuff that's been discovered at very low frequency.
Right, I thought you
could say like SZ effect and things like that. No, so that's the whole, so the SZ for the whole sky, the averaged SZ, is a few times 10 to the minus 7, I think, in Y, right? Which is more than an order of magnitude improvement. I mean, that's why everybody used to be measuring the spectrum and they moved to the anisotropies. Because the spectrum is just a black body, damn it, right? And then the deviations, expected deviations from the spectrum are really small. Okay, so have I convinced you that you need to worry about what the parameters are a little bit?
No. So why if you measure that 10 times better, you have to worry? What is the worry?
Because you can only get to this digit, right?
In what sense? No, so if you measure it again, you'll get to a better accuracy? So
for our Hubble patch.
Yes.
Right? I'm not telling you that there's a significance in whether it is different. I'm telling you that you then have to worry about cosmic variance in this guy. Right? So then, you know, there's another example, which is, I don't know if it's clear, but we're not as close to being at the limit yet. But I mean, the omegas themselves have a fluctuation on the Hubble scale. And that fluctuation, again, is a few times 10 to the minus 5, and it could be 3 sigma. So by the time omega is measured to 10 to the minus 4, we're done, right? So if the universe continues to look flat, right? And it's 1.0000, and then we don't know, right? Then we will never know whether the universe, right, being the background that you imagine living in, is open, closed, or flat, right? If the universe is open or closed, we'll have to learn that before we get to the fourth digit, right? Does that make sense? And people are talking about 21 centimeter experiments on the other side of the moon in 50 years or whatever, where you can get down there, right? So it is possible to measure enough information inside the Hubble patch to measure global omegas, but only for us. Right? If you want to learn a little more about that, then there's another paper which I wrote with Jim Zubin, which is a fantastic paper, one of the best papers that I've ever had my name on. I can say that because Jim Zubin did almost everything. So this is called Gauging the CMB, and in it we discuss what it means to have a variance of the monopole because there's gauge issues and stuff, which you have to think about carefully about. So we discuss the variance of the monopole and the dipole and what that really means and do a whole bunch of detailed calculations.
Just measure it to the points. So I'm not quite sure.
You can still define. Well, you can define.
I just
that.
Sit here and I measure the monopole and span. Why is that gauge?
So let's take the dipole, right?
It's just an observed quantity of one point, so it should be completely gauge.
Right, but I can gauge in the sense of I can just boost, right, and I measure a different dipole.
Every observer can see a different thing.
Yeah.
So if you divide the observer.
Yeah. Okay. And the monopole is the same. I can just cut around potentials and I get a different temperature.
Right.
So the question is, what does it mean to say what does it mean to say there's a variance in T naught? What whose variance? What
okay.
For
so
what?
It's just carefully defining
you. So you need to think about what that really means. But it turns out that you can define the variance of the monopole and the variance of the dipole. And then there's issues of what it means if the dipole is not the velocity. And there's all this question of having a tilted universe with isocurvature and large scales, and it's all in here. And there's a similar paper by Eric Check et al. And I'm trying not to pick on people in the audience, but it's a fantastic paper, but I don't understand it really. But I'm sure it's the same because the answers are the same. Okay, so so I think I've motivated a little bit that parameters can be stochastic. So can we have a more dramatic variation of parameters with space and time than the stuff that I've already told you about? So the stuff I've already told you about is real, right? So the nuts and bolts physical cosmologist has time varying and space varying parameters in some weak sense, right? But can we have parameters that actually vary in a more fundamental way? And what about physics in general, not just the parameters? So could physics vary between volumes of the universe or even between universes, which is the thing Neil alluded to earlier? So, so there is this thing which used to have a name, but then everybody called it the A word. And now it has a new name, which sometimes people call the L word, except the L word is a TV show, which is, so it's not the same thing. Everybody has a slightly different name for this thing so that they get taken seriously and their colleagues don't titter. So my sort of picture is that there's different bubbles in which intelligent beings have called it a different thing. So you get to pick which of these bubbles you live in, which one you like, right? And my favorite is the misanthropic principle, which is up here, which is that the universe hates us. Okay, so let me talk a little then about how you might do that and why it's important to be dimensionless, which is a thing I've been working on with a new grad student. So what parts of physics might vary? The obvious thing to vary is what we normally call the constants, but then which of the constants are allowed to vary? And it turns out that you're only really allowed to talk about dimensionless combinations of the constants, unless you have some other physical theory already in mind, in which you can talk about things in a different way. So you can talk about alpha, the mass ratios, et cetera, et cetera. And the hard parts here are done by my student, Ali Narimani. There's a long historical debate about units. So there's a bunch of people weighing in on here, like Maxwell, Rayleigh, working through, there's a fantastically clear paper by Dickey. And the consensus is that you really need to focus on things that are dimensionless, okay? But some people still argue with that. There are things in the literature by people who are genuinely smart, probably smarter than me, but they've totally got confused and screwed up about this stuff, right? And I can name names afterwards, right? And if there's anybody like that in the audience, this is now's your chance to argue with.
Okay, so
okay, good.
So there is a statement that any observable is dimensionless.
Yeah.
Right? That doesn't make sense. But obviously we could do better things than we quote units. So.
Yeah, so you sometimes forget that it's a dimensionless thing. So by quoting units, you're comparing to a thing.
Yeah, so the thing is that...
And it's the comparison is really the measurement, right? Because you have to calibrate whatever you're doing.
That's right. But so the point is that so whenever you quote the unit, you have a calibration in mind, and the actual measurement is unitless.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's just a choice of convention that somehow we find more comfortable to use like universal units like kilograms.
Yeah, I'm not saying units are not useful.
So what are you saying?
I'm saying if you vary the physics, then you have to realize that what you're really varying, if it's meaningful, is the dimensionless thing. And not the unit.
But I can still choose, as long as my calibration doesn't change, and that's the big issue.
Right.
I think. It might be more convenient to describe things in terms of what we're doing.
Yeah, so one good example to think of, if is everybody good with this, or is this new to people, or no? if this is new to you, it's a little hard to get your head around, and you have to think about it for a bit, because people are convinced that you can measure the speed of light varying, for example. And you can have conversations with people that last a really long time in which you think you're done, and then they say, no, but hold on a minute. I can just take a meter stick and a clock, damn it, right? And I measure how long photons take to, right? And if it's different tomorrow than it is today, the speed of light's changed. I don't care what you say, you're right.
So this brings up an important point, right? So I have multiple definitions for what I might call a clock, and that means that I'm dimensionalizing my time in different ways. So I make a comparison. So for example, maybe I compare against muon neutrinos. Maybe I compare against photons or something like this. How did I define my clock?
Yes.
And so once I absolutely believe, I think, you know, this is like traditional gauge invariance, 19th century gauge invariance. We want to be removing units from our equation. But then how you've decided to do that introduces a theoretical bias in what you think the important knobs in your theory is. So for example, I can weigh the universe in pint masses.
Yeah.
It would be kind of difficult and give me sort of crazy numbers to deal with, that it's not clear that those are meaningful numbers. Maybe the matter radiation density ratio is a much more physical thing that matters. But I've introduced a bias once I've chosen some way to dimensionalize or rationalize my equation. So not entirely.
So I would say we have a construct, which is our current model of physics, and the dimensionality of that model is clear. And the dimensionlessness of measurements is built into that structure. So there's five dimensions in the 19th century physics model, right? And there it is. So if you want to do something else, you're totally free to do that, but you need a new physical construct in which you can talk meaningfully about some other thing, right? So that's fine, but you can't do it in general, because I don't know what you mean, right? So you can measure that the speed of light is different than the speed of gravitons, if you like, I think. But now you need to tell me what your construct is for how those are different and how that affects the structure of space-time, and maybe the gravitons are in the bulk or something and it's different.
So I think
so then that might be meaningful, right?
Yeah.
But you need an extra thing on top of what we know in order to talk about this. You can't just say, oh, I can measure the speed of light's different, and that's just your bias. Right? So provided you have another thing in mind, then we can talk, right? But the speed of light, what we learned in special relativity is there's time dilation for clocks, where clocks means mirrors and light thingies, but that's all clocks, right? So there's no, so I mean, if there's a problem measuring the speed of light for any measurement that I can think of, there's a problem for all measurements. So it's clear now, it's manifest in the definition of the meter, right? Which fixes the speed of light to be, you know, 299792458, full stop, right? So you cannot, in the current SI units, measure the speed of light, even, right? In some fundamental sense. And it's true for all the other things that are dimensionful. And somebody can say, no, but hold on a minute, I can just take a meter stick in it, right? So how did you calibrate the meter stick? How did you calibrate the clock? It all comes back to the definition of, and you're done. So if you have another speed in your theory, right? And let's not mention neutrinos here, because that's a different lunchtime conversation. Then you can talk, right? But you need a framework to do that, yeah.
So the meter is now defined in terms of the speed of light. So I create a reference meter and transport that meter somewhere else in the universe.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm assuming that the physics that determines that length corresponds to a meter is the same as somewhere else in the universe. That's an assumption I'm making. Now,
So that is an assumption, and I would claim it's a testable assumption, and the only way to test it is with something dimensionless. Unless you have a totally different physical idea in mind that I don't yet understand, right? If you're talking about just varying the sort of standard physics, then I don't know how you do that without a dimensionless quantum.
But when you're talking about something dimensionless, then you go to the kilogram.
Yeah.
I could define the kilogram as being some number of hydrogen atoms.
Yeah.
And which on Earth happens to correspond to what we call a kilogram. Now I could take that number of hydrogen atoms elsewhere, and I could define ratios of the gravitational force to the electromagnetic force that I get elsewhere, and I might find that actually I get a different ratio elsewhere in the universe.
So my claim would be, if you do it with gravity, there's nothing you can do to break out of the fact that mass is mass and G is G, and there you go. What you need to do is use atomic physics to get some kind of dynamical thing related to atomic physics, and then what you'd find is that you brought in alpha. And otherwise, you can't talk about how it varied. So you just need to think of the thought experiment and what you would really do, and I think you'll find that there's nothing you can do to break out of that except with dimensionless numbers, but which you'll see in a second. So this is connected with dimensional analysis, which I just learned because I read the paper was invented by Maxwell in the 1870s. There's a fantastic paper that he wrote for a bunch of mathematicians. It's in the proceedings of the Cambridge Mathematical Society or some slightly bizarro journal that you can't find really in a library, but Google finds it for you. It's not a very long paper. In which he's sort of talking to mathematicians and saying, well, let me talk to you about the structure of physics. And he gives all his sort of ideas about it. So it's the first paper where he wrote down, we have capital M for mass and capital L for, right? And it's like, it's a paragraph where he defines dimensional analysis for the first time in a long paper. And then he goes on to talk about vector fields and scalar fields and those little diagrams that look like E and B modes in the CMB and stuff. It's the first paper where he really talked about divergence and curl, and the six other things where it's also the first paper where it was ever. It's quite fantastic. Okay, so we were talking about alpha there and G. So let me be a little more explicit. So in cosmology, the only really important dimensionless constants that we talk about are these guys. So there's the usual alpha, and I've written it here in SI units, which might be unfamiliar for some of you, but there's like 4 pi's and epsilon naughts and things. And then there's a thing that we sometimes define as the fine structure constant for gravity, which is just saying gravity and electrostatics are the same, and G is 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, right? So this is also dimensionless, right? I need a mass squared in here. And you can argue about what's in there, but I'm really an astrophysicist, and the universe is full of protons, damn it, and I'm going to use the proton mass, because it's the obvious thing. There's the mass ratio of electrons to protons is important. There's other stuff that you could derive using the standard model of particle physics, but it's pretty much irrelevant for most of cosmology. So these are the three things that might be important for anything I measure. And then there's one other thing which I can define, which I'm going to call theta, which is the dimensionless temperature. So this tells me what time it is, right? So the idea is I could, in principle, contact aliens in a different bubble of the universe, and we could have a conversation about what values we have for these guys, right? And we could talk about whether it's Wednesday or Thursday for us, right? Okay? So let me just define what these are, an electromagnetic fine structure constant, the gravitational fine structure constant, electron to proton mass ratio, and the dimensionless CMB temperature, which is a timing.
Lambda.
Sorry?
Lambda.
Yeah, sure, right. It varies with, is little lambda?
Big lambda.
Big lambda. Well, big lambda varies with time for the usual reason, right? It's because it's a rubbish thing to big lambda, sorry.
Yeah.
Omega lambda varies with time for the usual reason that it's a rubbish parameter.
Yeah, big lambda, I mean.
So big lambda could vary with time, it's true.
No, I mean it should be a dimensionless.
Yeah. It just doesn't vary with time, as we know.
Oh, you're writing down things which do vary?
Which might vary with time in the slightly crazier model than you normally think about.
Big lambda would vary with
Agreed. I agree with Neil. I have it right. I have it now on record that one time in my life I have agreed with Neil.
Sorry.
Okay, good. Those were all earlier in the parameter model, right? These are new. These are new parameters that might vary, right? That's the idea. There's this classic book by Bridgman, which Google will also find for you if you can't be bothered to go to the library. Bridgman won the Nobel Prize for high pressure physics, I think. Not a field I really follow. But he wrote this short monograph on dimensional analysis, which is very, very readable. There's a long introductory section where he apologizes for writing on such a trivial subject. So you know you're in good shape, right? But then he goes through a whole bunch of the arguments. And one of the things that he does in there is explains that that if you want to talk about how your measurement is not just units, then you should imagine a thought experiment in which you're corresponding with people in a different city or a different country where they use really bizarre units. Not very difficult for Canadians to imagine. Right? So what we're saying is that you can, in order to think about physics varying from one place to another and how meaningful that would be, you should think about aliens, right? So the idea is to be able to discuss these measurements. So what I'm imagining is I contact these aliens through some imaginative way that it can't really happen, right? They're in a different causal patch or something. And we start exchanging information about concepts, so we eventually figure out what we mean by the word mass, right? And then we say, you know, the particle that's like really common. Well, take the mass of that guy, and then the other particle that's just about as common but has the opposite charge. Now take the ratio of those two guys. What do you get, right? So you can imagine having this conversation. So that's clearly a meaningful thing that's completely independent of units in whatever volume of the universe you're in. So you can do the same thing for alpha sub g. You can do the same thing for alpha and so on. And then you could do the same thing for lambda and curvature and whatever the other things are, as long as they're dimensionless, right? And then you still have to say, what time is it? Because we could be living in the same Friedman model, but a billion years later, right? So we could actually be corresponding with ourselves back in time or something, right? So I think this sort of aliens thought experiment thing is actually helpful, even though it sounds a little bit crazy, because Bridgman said it was good, and he's like a real physicist that won a Nobel Prize for doing not crazy things. So let me give you a couple of examples of how you would do this, and this is the work of Ali Narimani, my student. So Big Bang nucleosynthesis, we know, depends on the value of big G. Big G, in all the literature on this stuff, is completely dimensionful. People talk about big G dot over big G. Sometimes they say, since we talk about G dot over G, that's dimensionless, so it's all good, right, even. So what we've done here is tried to write it down in a dimensionless way. So this is the variation of the helium abundance in terms of the main physics. It depends on the ratio of neutrons to protons, which is a dimensionless number. It depends on this mass defect, which you can write down dimensionlessly. It depends on the binding energy of deuterium, which has some function that depends on strong physics. It depends on the decay time of the neutron, which depends on some weak physics and so on. And you can make these two guys dimensionless quite easily. So you can write down the whole thing in an explicitly dimensionless way. As far as we can tell, most of the stuff that's published is in fact correct, even although it's dimensionful. If you just multiply by the proton mass squared, it kind of goes through and it's all good, I think. With a couple of exceptions where I really didn't quite understand what they were doing. So another example is cosmological recombination. The universe is ionized, it becomes neutral. So you can write down the rate of change of the ionized fraction, right, as a function of redshift. So this is dimensionless. You can make all of this dimensionless. So this is just Saha equation, it's just atomic physics. And then all you have is there's a bunch of atomic physics in here, which depends on different, they all depend on alpha g to the minus a half, because that's just a Hubble rate. But they depend on different powers of alpha, because different things in atoms depend on different powers of alpha, right? So you can write down this completely explicitly dimensionlessly. So you can either think of this as being there's alpha and alpha g at last scattering, and I compare that to alpha and alpha g today. And that's just like communicating with the aliens in a different universe, right? They have a different set of parameters because it's there compared to, I mean, it's there and then compared to here and now, right? So it's much easier to make sure that you've got things dimensionless by comparing the two epochs. And then once you've done that, you can talk about actually time-varying alpha and so on, which is a bunch more complicated because there's a line of sight effect. But until you've got the simple thing right, you're going to screw up. So just to show you that we can do real calculations, here's how recombination varies if you make a 1% change in the fine structure constant or a 1% change in the fine structure constant due to gravity. So now things are more complicated. And some papers are wrong, right? And the reason some papers are wrong is because the time that we define the universe today is a special time. So the issue is what to keep constant. So in other words, if g varies, you're essentially on a different Friedman model. So if I define today to be the Hubble constant or the temperature of the CMB, right? And then I vary g, then those two numbers no longer define the same epoch, right? So you can't just throw g into a Fisher matrix thing with all the other parameters without taking into account the fact that the model is varying, right? So I won't name names, but there's a bunch of my colleagues who've worked on this, and it was wrong. So at least one set of colleagues, when we wrote to them, I mean, I thought it was only polite to send them a copy of the paper saying, nah, we think you're wrong. And so one of the sets of colleagues said, yeah, but we knew we were wrong. So if you read really carefully in the conclusions, we say this is just a toy model, and it's probably not completely self-consistent. So then I wrote back to them and said, so I'm supposed to change the wording of our paper to say they're wrong, but they knew they were wrong, and that's somehow better? And they haven't got back to me, so I'm not quite sure what we're supposed to say. So the better thing to do to make sure that you're not screwing up this today a special thing is to define the standard model to be dimensionless. So here's a table with here's the coupling constants, right? I mean, this guy is really small, like normal. We could get in touch with the aliens and say, okay, let's pick a fiducial epoch, right? The aliens are going to say, what do you mean by the word fiducial, right? And then we're going to say nothing, right? It's just one of those words physicists use. It doesn't mean anything. And then once we've got over that, we agree to pick, say, equality. So we pick the time when the total omega in matter and the total omega in radiation are equal, and they're both basically a half. Some of the radiation is photons, and some of it's neutrinos. Some of the matter is CDM, some of it's baryons, but these guys all together add up to a half. There's a little bit of lambda at that epoch, right? It's small, but it's not negligible. And then theta at that epoch, right, is some number. And then for now, we can say the redshift of equality, or we can say theta today, right, the temperature today. So this is dimensionless cosmological model. And we went to the trouble, actually, of running WMAP chains, so these actually have error bars, right? So this is the current estimate that if we got in touch with these aliens that live 10 billion years in the past or in a different universe, we would have this conversation with them. So I think this is somewhat useful, and as far as I can tell, has not really been written down before, because people normally think of now as being just absolutely fixed. Because they're essentially they are fixed, right? So the error bar on these guys comes from the CMB temperature, and the WMAP chains don't care about that. So the error bars are much, much smaller than these, right? Because they come from. So I've run out of time here, but let me at least tell you what I was going to say in the last topic, and I can talk more about it with other people if they care. So the last topic is what happens if now physics varies in space. So this is, the topic is tilted physics, and this is in collaboration with, again, the postdocs Adam Moss and Jim Zubin, with help from an undergrad that worked with me over the summer, Joel Hutchinson. So the idea here is, imagine that physics varies over large scales. So maybe one thing that people work on, and I was going to pick on Matt Johnson, but he's not even here, so it's no fun, but some crazy people work on bubble collisions, and imagine that we might see that for physics in different regions of the universe. But maybe the second craziest idea is that you could detect a gradient across the universe. So the picture here is, this is the last scattering surface. We live in the center of the universe, as you know. You say that to undergraduate students, and they all nod vigorously, because this is the me generation. Right? This is the horizon at last scattering. It's small. That's the point. So you imagine a gradient across the universe, right? Then the gradient across here is negligible. So at every place on the last scattering surface, there's a value for the parameters. But I can make the parameters vary across the last scattering surface. And that's a gradient across the patch, which is a cos theta variation on the sky. So I can work out the CMB anisotropies at every place, right? But then the parameters at the place depend on cos theta. So then I can, what I've done is dipole modulate the CMB anisotropies. So this was already considered by Kamienkowski, Carl, Eric Check, and a whole bunch of other people for the amplitude of the spectrum. But as I've now, I hope, told you about, there's a whole bunch of other parameters, so there's no reason really to pick on A. So you could pick some other parameter. And if you don't like physics varying, like alpha or something, if that's uncomfortable to you, then just make it helium abundance, right? So there's a sort of mildly inhomogeneous nucleosynthesis. Helium has a gradient across the universe, perfectly kind of reasonable thing to imagine. What would that do to the CMB anisotropies? It turns out that the math here is exactly the same as has been worked out for aberration. So aberration is that we're moving through the sea of CMB photons. One half of the CMB sky is squished and the other half is stretched. We're moving at 1%, 0.1% of the speed of light, basically, so it's a 1 part in 10 to the 3 effect. So that means that L of 1,000 on one part of the sky becomes 999, and on the other side of the sky it's 1,001. You basically measure in two different halves of the sky, subtract the things. If you get a residual that looks like the CLs, then you've measured the aberration. For Planck, this turns out to be a 5 or 6 sigma effect expected. So it is measurable. It's a really, really bad way of measuring the dipole, right? So for aberration, what you're doing actually is this spatial thing while making an L equals 2 mode. For these other things, you don't necessarily make L equals 2, right? So if you change the helium abundance everywhere, you haven't changed the temperature structure of the universe. There's no dipole you've created, but you still dipole modulate the sky. Dipole modulation, as we all know, because we're all theoretical physicists here, you can calculate through a Wigner 3J symbol, right? So you modulate the sky with L equals 1, you couple the modes with plus or minus 1, right? So each L mode gets coupled to L of plus or minus 1. So what you can do is look for coupling between adjacent L modes, and that will be a signature of this gradient across the universe, okay? And the signature of the gradient across the universe will have the same math. The coupling is a Wigner 3J symbol, so it's just math. Right, but the amplitude of the coupling will be a function of L, and it's a different function of L depending on which parameter is varying. So in principle, you take the data, you look for coupling between L and L plus 1, and then depending on what coupling you see as a function of L, you can tell that alpha is varying across the universe, or the helium abundance, or it's the amplitude, or it's some other parameter or combination of parameters. So I'm not suggesting that this is doable in the sense that I'm not, you know, I would eat my hat if we found there was a gradient across the universe. But I'm suggesting that there's models you can imagine in which physics varies on large scales. The first thing you would notice is a gradient. It might be there, but you can look for it for free. We already have the data. It's the Planck data, it's in the can. The first Planck results will be January 2013. They will be spectacular. And then maybe a year later, we'll try this thing, right? So in the interests of time, I'm gonna not go into this stuff in any more detail, but I can talk about this with people over lunch or something, but let me stop there. Thank you.
So questions for Atlas?
There's been almost no arguing so far. Oh, okay, good.
Just to return to the temporal variations. So am I correct in summing up the statement, or summing up that section roughly with the statement that it's insufficient to simulate the universe we think we're modeling, but it's also necessary to understand in detail and include the aspect of measurement when you make comparisons. That you can always represent the whole system, both the universe you're measuring and the apparatus that you measure it with, in these rationalized units, and therefore only rationalized quantities, dimensionless quantities matter. The great hope is, and this is what I was trying to get out of bias, is that you only need to know about a handful of these dimensionless quantities, and all the rest of them are happily constant. So for example, don't really have to worry too much about the mass ratio between the electron and the muon, that might stay constant, but alpha is what really matters or something.
Okay. Yeah, so I mean there is this sort of hope coming out of the landscape or something. That by thinking about it long and hard enough, it will be obvious which parameters are deterministic because they're just math. And they come out of some group or something, and which parameters are stochastic. So I've heard that hope expressed several different times before. I don't think it's been fulfilled. But yeah, and there's a big argument about how many dimensions there are and so on, right? So there's a long literature on this, which I can point you to if you're interested.
Other questions? But I guess just maybe I'll ask the last question. So when you said you need, if you want to measure the variation of dimension full constant, you mentioned you need a physical construct or something, right?
So if you have a picture in mind in which that's meaningful, then you have to tell me about it so that we can discuss that. But if you're just saying I have standard physics and I let this thing vary, then...
But then it's not physics.
Then I don't know what that means, right?
So saying that equally applies to dimension full or dimension less parameters.
Yeah. So this whole thing about the varying G is not general relativity.
Exactly.
And probably every theory in which G varies is a scalar tensor theory.
Well, we know G varies in a scalar tensor theory, but I don't think that every theory in which G varies is a scalar tensor.
I'm sorry, that's why I said probably. So that's Ali's PhD thesis topic. I told him I know the answer, he just has to figure out and come back and tell me, and I'll nod wisely and say, oh yeah, I knew that. So the idea is to try to see how much progress we can make in understanding. If you say you have a theory in which G runs or varies in time, are all those theories essentially the same or wrong in some sense, right? That's the question. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, so if there is no very final burning question,